This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday, the 14th of August on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexis. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. Coming up on this week's show, we sit down with London-based designer Dominic Wilcox to hear all about his latest project. It's an LP called The Sounds of Making in East London, and it does what it says on the tin. We'll be hearing from the people in London who make this noise. That's a vinyl cutter in Hackney. We'll also hear from the people behind this. That's the Whitechapel Bell Foundry, Britain's oldest manufacturer. And can you guess what this is? It's the very East London tradition of making pies and mash. More on that and much besides coming up in the show. Elsewhere in this week's episode, we'll also hear about the favourite things of Gonzalo Fonseca, the charismatic founder of Madrid leather goods brand Steve Mono. And we'll take a tour around Berlin store Collor and hear how the owners are staying ahead of the pack on their retail patch. That's all to come on this week's episode of Section D. We start this week in Berlin, a city renowned and loved for the opportunities available to its young creatives, who flock there from around the world to experiment. It's a laboratory for interesting concepts, and one such creation is Prenzlauerberg studio and store, Collor. Our reporter Melanie Shevchenko dropped by to find out from Collor's owners and designers, Tatiana Ryman and Uli Meyer, to find out the secrets behind their success.
Collor is a small design boutique located in a quiet neighborhood in Berlin. For partners Tatiana Ryman and Uli Meyer, starting simple is the key. Ryman explains.
I would call it living products, also to make living more comfortable and more beautiful. We like organic, if it's possible. We like regional production, if it's possible. And we also like perhaps to do recycle a lot, or recycle new and old, combine it, upcycle perhaps. And we also think about products perhaps which could be more practical and more beautiful, which exist already but could get a new face.
Take, for example, a colorfully designed fixture and cable for a hanging light, looking almost like a jump rope. These fixtures, available in bright green, orange, or yellow, take an ordinary and unattractive object that's difficult to avoid and drastically improve its form.
Actually, all these things are very ugly, which you find in a hardware store, plastic from China for €2. Our best product are the cables. Everybody loves them. Because we use them in the shop too, everybody really... A lot of people come in and say, we just want this, in a way, in our wherever kitchen or living room.
Starting out as architects, Meyer and Ryman shifted their careers when they launched a publishing company called Berliner Luft, for which they designed architectural postcards.
The study of the architecture is, I think, basically about design and about aesthetics, about material. I think every architect should be a good interior designer too, because he's actually building homes for people, and that's why he should be able to do nice products too, because I mean furniture is a product too, and furniture should be in a nice interior, so it's all combined in a way.
Meyer and Ryman came up with the idea for their studio 4 years ago, but it wasn't until 2 years ago that they opened a shop in Prenzlauerberg.
And then step by step we developed products which were easy to produce, which we could afford to produce, and which we starting selling in our shop too, which were a success in the shop. Then we tried, okay, we go further, and so on and on it developed. But it's really working pretty well that you find out what is a good product and what can work, and it's nice to be in contact with the people to ask them, okay, what do you like about that, and what could be better, and so it's more like a shop, a showroom, and a, I don't know, meeting space in a way.
They walk me over to a series of tables and shelves, made from the doors of old East German apartment buildings, which they found on the street.
This table is of old GDR furniture, and we just took the
doors from the wardrobe.
Yeah, and we just made like new cubes actually out of it, and we had some for the shelves. We had some old doors which we just cut. So all these are just doors. They are made of cardboard inside. So, but these were from the GDR, and they still have this very old smell actually, and the colors too. And we liked it in a way, so we just sticked with it.
Meyer and Ryman show me around the shop, pointing out some choice designs, including paper books and office supplies, postcards, shelving units, rolls of colored adhesive tape, tote bags, and handbags. Hello.
Hello.
A lot of stationery stuff, some kitchen stuff, some furniture, some children's stuff too. Then another product is the paper bag, which we had the idea to do because, I mean, everybody has this recycling paper in his kitchen or office, and we just made a pink writing on it, and that's it actually, but it's much nicer.
Meyer says they often exhibit their work at design fairs, where they have the opportunity to meet new designers whose products they also sell in their shop.
So we just went to Early Bird in Hamburg, it's a design fair, and we just found these very nice post-its. It's like, you know, just in leaves and flowers, and it's very nice, I think. And you can put them on the wall, and then you have a tree.
When it comes to inspiration, Ryman says it can come from anywhere at any time.
Sometimes you see a thing you like, but you think, well, it could be better, and perhaps that could be a start for a new product.
Though they find inspiration from experimental designs, Meyer and Ryman admit that they're more interested in designing products that have the potential to sell, basically products that are functional at their core, simple and durable.
We do everything on our own. We distribute everything, we produce it, and we don't sell our designs to big companies. We really try to produce them ourselves.
At the moment, they're looking to develop objects for the kitchen, as well as a series of tea towels, and to expand their design of the paper recycling bags. Though not so keen on plastics, Meyer and Ryman work with metal, wood, and paper.
It's really interesting because you really have to find out, okay, which material is affordable too for us to produce. It's always very complicated to come to this point where you are really satisfied with the product.
Yeah, and sometimes you don't know which direction it will take. You start and you have an idea perhaps of material and shape, but it will end somewhere else.
One of my favorite products is the traveling toiletries bag, produced from the same material as a flying kite.
The material is actually for, how do you call them? Kites, yeah, for kites. And it's very strong and very, very light. And you can use them, I don't know, we use them actually for when we're traveling, we put our bathroom stuff inside. I don't know the word in English,
yeah.
But
yeah. Toiletries.
Toiletries, yeah. Yeah, we like it a lot because it's so, has a good haptic too, and very colorful. We always like colors, like the name says.
And from the German capital, we now head to the Spanish capital. Barcelona leather goods brand Steve Mono is a well-kept secret among the more discerning, dapper gentlemen of the world. It was founded by Gonzalo Fonseca, and our Madrid correspondent Liam Aldus swung by his Malasaña studio to talk traditional stationery, Jacques Tati films, and animals.
The first object that I have chosen is something that is always with me. I think all the day, even when I go out at night, sometimes it's in my pocket. It's a classic Parker pen, always with ink blue. I don't know why, but it's always with ink blue. And I think that's because it's I like the style, I like the form. It's very comfortable for me in the hand. I like also drawing with pen, not with pencil. I have always drawn when I was a child. I used to draw a lot, many things, and I have always liked to draw with pen, not with pencil. Because it's maybe, when you are drawing with a pencil, you can then correct, and you can take out and then correct. But with a pen, what you have done is there. And maybe I'm more sure, and I'm more focused on what I'm doing, because I know that the things that I'm doing, I cannot correct. I think it's maybe because of this, that I like always to draw and to write with pen, no pencil. The stamps. This kind of rubber stamps, I think that they reminds me, you know, to this kind of offices, you know, from the 50s, from the 60s, when and where all the documents used to have a final stamp, you know, to be approved. It's a question because I have been working as a graphic designer for many, many years, and maybe with Steve Mono I wanted to create just something like the anti-graphic design. I don't know. Once more, back to the roots of everything. I like the idea of a white paper, you know, just with the logo maybe in gold, in a big car, in the paper, in a letter, in an envelope. To finish all the graphic just with a stamp, again in blue, if possible, with a stamp made also in a classic way, not in a modern way, because you know that now there are stamps, something like mechanical stamps, that they fix perfect the image, but not with this. That is not always perfect, but I love the idea of this. You know, with a mix with the wood, with the rubber, and with the inks. I think it's very funny at the same time, and it makes sense, you know, to the idea.
So tell me, now we're just walking on the street, but tell me about the film collection you have. That's one of the big influences in your design.
The influences is because, you know, I really love the Jacques Tati films, you know, the French director. It's not only the film, the history, it's not the less important, but it's just one point more in the films. It's everything involving each one. It's, you know, it's the set, it's the characters, it's the dresses, it's the animals with many dogs. Always, there are always dogs, you know, in the films, same than this one. The music, I love the music of the Jacques Tati films. And it's something very, you know, classic, but with a twist, with a touch of humor, with...
There's a dog right there, right on cue.
And it's something, I think, is this kind of things that I always like, you know, in everything you have seen before, you know, even with the collection, with the designs, with the graphic, with everything. It's classic, basic, but even sometimes with a touch of surrealistic things.
And which is your favorite film in this collection?
Mon Uncle. Mm-hmm. Mi tío in Spanish. It's a wonderful for everything, because of the uncle by himself, because of the children playing in the gardens, because of the family, because of the sister of the, you know, of the man is amazing. The house, the way Jacques Tati used to think about the future, it's amazing. You know, this, there are some stands in the film, very funny, you know, real funny, with this kind of animal form, fountains, you know, in the garden of the house, something very plastic, really funny, I love. So this is my house, so Ongi Etorri.
Is that Basque for welcome?
Ongi Etorri is welcome, okay. In Basque. Mm-hmm.
So we're now comfortably sitting at your place of residence, and you've got some metallic animals, some figurines.
Yeah, these are silver figures I have taken, you know, from my parents' house. I think that each time I visit them, I used to take one with me, in my case. You can see here, you know, two fishes, something like very, these are from the 60s, and they are very special because you can play even with them, and you can move, and this is something like very surrealistic things, maybe. You have also some birds, more fishes. These are the kind of things that were, you know, in the table of my parents' house in the sitting room.
And what is the connection to animals? Because obviously you've got the eight framed pictures or the portraits of the dogs as well. So
I love the animals since always, since I was a child. I used also to spend my summer, you know, in a small village in Soria. It's one small city in Castilla León here in Spain. And I used to go to a small village where part of my family used to live. And they have a lot of animals there. And I spent many, many, many days, you know, taking care of them, the chickens, the rabbits, the cows, the horses, everything. I have always wanted to own a dog, but for the moment it's impossible for me because of my work. You know, I'm always traveling from one place to another. That's where I have also, as you can see, a series of eight dog portraits made in the same way as if they were persons, you know, or a family or something. They are from the 60s or from the 70s, maybe, I don't know, and they have, you know, a lot of peculiar, you know, dogs. You know, you can see there the Schnauzer, the Afghan Lebrel, the San Bernardo, Pastor de Brie, Tekel, Fox Terrier, Boxer, and the Poodle. So it's, for me, it's very, very special. I like a lot this idea. And they are with me since I moved to my first house.
So would you like to take a seat?
Yeah. Sure. And I would sit in the first chair I bought by myself. It was really cheap. I found it in a flea market in Bilbao. This is the first piece I bought for my first house, living on my own, when I was, I don't know, 24, something like that. I found it and I thought it was the perfect piece, you know, for my first apartment. It's from the 50s, it's a very typical design from the Spanish 50s. I think it's very inspired also, you know, for the Danish furnitures and design. It's really comfortable, and it's the place where I used to sit, you know, when I arrive home sometimes, or maybe when I have to think about something. And it's a good place, you know, just to think or to sit or maybe to have some drink.
That was Gonzalo Fonseca of Steve Mono, taking Liam Aldus through a few of his favourite things in Madrid. Time for a short break before we explore the unusual sounds of the many makers in East London. But before that, this is Spanish dance group DeLorean with Endless Sunset.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Perfect accompaniment to summer is a well-mixed cocktail, so as the season hits its stride, we handpicked a trio of bartenders from around the world to prepare for us their cocktail du jour. From Tokyo to São Paulo via Beirut, we filmed the maestros at work, headlining the Yoshida Martini, the Lychee Caipirinha, and the Aromatic Smash. Pull up a bar stool for a front row seat. Monocle Films on monocle.com.
Welcome back. We've spoken often here of the enterprising creative community in London and the many ways in which everyone's sought to capitalise on the Olympics. Create is an East London creative agency, and it commissioned local design producer Torsten van Elten to work with five designers together to produce alternative souvenirs for East London. Dominic Wilcox was one of the five designers, and he struck gold. He embarked on a project to knock on the doors and shutters around East London and record the sounds made by the studios and people who still make things. The range of makers he discovered was as vast and varied as the sounds they made, including chefs, illustrators, food and drinks producers, and industrial manufacturers. And everyone had its own intriguing story. He turned the 21 recordings into a vinyl called The Sounds of Making in East London. As a souvenir, it serves to promote the craft and industry that is alive and ticking, busy working, busy making behind closed doors in East London. Wilcox joined me in the studio to tell me more.
It was a challenge of thinking about East London and what is particular about East London. That's maybe the West is different to West London, for example, where you normally get the souvenirs in the shop. So it was really thinking about that. And of course, East London doesn't have the grand buildings and the, you know, the sort of typical souvenir things. So you had to think quite carefully.
And also, I suppose people outside of London associate East London a lot with this sort of rich pie and mash sort of Cockney sort of heritage that it has.
Yeah, and I mean, that's still, you know, it's still there and it's still important, of course. But of course, there is the other side of the creativity. And the number of makers. Of course, East London was always known for making factories, but now that, I mean, particularly now, there's a lot of individual makers, you know, small makers who make bespoke items or, you know, one-off amazing artwork or lots of different types of food as well. And so this is where my idea came from, to really try and capture a sample. You can't capture it all, but just to capture a sample of the makers of East London.
So you have compiled this record that visits a series of different makers, like you mentioned there. It's everything from food to clothing and craft and a huge range of different people, and recorded the noises that are made.
Yeah. So simply, I discovered, I talked with people, word of mouth, to find out some interesting or historical or skillful makers around East London. Then I contacted them. I'd telephone them up, email them, whatever. Keep on talking to them until they had a vague idea of what I was talking about. You know, I want to visit and record the sound of you chopping things up or hitting with a hammer. Yeah. And so I visited them. And simply recorded the sound of them making, as though I wasn't in the room. That's what I wanted. So we had a chat and we got relaxed. And then, you know, they just carried on as normal. And what's interesting is, of course, each maker has their own sounds that they hear all their lives, every day. And I guess we don't get let into that world, but that is their world. And so I wanted to just capture that feeling, that moment. Yeah.
How, I mean, you mentioned there that you did a lot of talking and a lot of phoning around, but do you live in East London?
I do, yeah, I live in Hackney.
Okay, and were you aware of a lot of these people before, or were these...
I mean, obviously, because, you know, I've lived here and I work in the creative world, whatever, so I do know some, but I have to say the majority of them I didn't know, and actually I found that more interesting, because what was great about it was that I had an opportunity to meet people and see what they did. And actually, because I'm a creative person, I'm looking for inspiration and ideas and, you know, ways of making things in a different way. And so I was actually using it in a way for myself as well.
Amazing research material.
Yes, exactly.
Education for you too. Well, shall we hear a sound now? Do you want to choose one that you feel was sort of maybe surprising for you, or something that has a bit of a story to it that's unlocks the project?
The first sound was recording at the record maker who made the records. So I went along and I thought, well, for the first sound, let's start with the making of the vinyl record. And the reason why I chose the vinyl record, of course, is because it's an object. It's a thing that's made. You can feel it in your hand. You can see the music in the grooves. And it's not an MP3 file that you can't you can't wrap that up and give that as a present. So yes, the first sound was at the music recording studio.
Let's play it. Extraordinary. It sounds like something from a science fiction film, isn't it?
It was. It was actually, the first one was a reel-to-reel tape machine.
Oh, really?
So you know, to make a record, with the recording of the sound of a tape machine. And then the second part, they have a record cutter, so you see, they record the music and then they pipe it into this machine, which then etches the grooves into an acrylic disc. And that's a reverse, the opposite of what your record is. That's what the presses are made from.
What you mentioned earlier about recording the noises and trying to get people to just do exactly as they do normally, and that these are the sounds that they hear every day. Do you think when you approached them and said, this is what I want to do, it sort of made them listen to it with fresh ears and think, oh my goodness, like actually these noises are such a part of my day-to-day life and I haven't actually really listened to them properly for such a long time. Have they sort of heard something new from this project?
I mean, I think at first they're obviously think this is a bit crazy. I mean, you know, what's so interesting about this? But they don't. To an outsider, you know. And what I really like about the sound is it plays with your imagination. You know, your imagination fills in this visual gap, and so we imagine the real and then the other sounds. And definitely, all of the makers were really enthusiastic. None of them said no. Once I'd explained what I was trying to do, they just found it interesting. And since the record's come out, of course, everybody's very enthusiastic to get a copy.
And nosy to hear what everybody else sounds like too. Would you like to choose another one for us to hear?
I visited Alga Works, who make spectacle frames. Now, they used to make most of the spectacle frames for the NHS for many, many years. And then that got privatised, and so they had to change completely their direction. And so they went very bespoke and make high-value spectacle frames. So they made Harry Potter's frames, for example, and the guy was talking about how the size of the glasses increased with every film. Started at size 5, apparently, for Harry. But they also made John Lennon's and Eric Clapton's, you know. So they've got this history. And so I went to visit this factory, went upstairs, and they have this huge room with hundreds of these, you know, industrial machines, the green-painted machines. But only a few people really work in there because they've downsized. So it's left over from the age when they were really churning them out now to bespoke items. So this sound is about 10 different machines around this room.
Amazing. Let's hear it. Funny when you say there that this is some machines in a room that used to make huge scale, you can kind of hear a bit of a sort of emptiness there too.
Yeah, but I mean, I think the business is doing very well, but they've just changed their scale and, you know, and took more time about making. Well, I don't know, but I don't know the details. It was really noisy actually when I was there talking to the guy, and Yeah, so that was a nice one.
Something you mentioned there as well is the sort of unearthing of stories that is so interesting. And on your site, you've done a range of spoken interviews with people who work at each of the places. Yeah. I mean, I, going through it, had no idea that the first manufacturer in, well, is it in England or in the UK, was Bell Foundry?
Yeah, the oldest manufacturer in Britain is in Whitechapel Bell Foundry. And they, you know, they made Big Ben's bell, for example, but they made the first Liberty bell. I say the first because it apparently had cracked in America. But, you know, I mean, and actually it can be traced further back to 1460-something, I can't remember, 1460s. And so this is a real historical place. And from the outside, it looks like this beautiful, just little shop. And then you go through to the back and, you know, it's huge bells strewn across the floor and, you know, men in uniforms and, yeah, so...
It's amazing. Well, we're going to hear the interview that you recorded and the sound of the bell thundering.
So what is this first bit you're going to... What are you doing? You've got a bell upturned in a clamp.
Yes, it's one of a set of bells from Great Shefford in Berkshire. The six bells were cast at different times by different founders, each with different ideas as to what bells should sound like.
Right.
And so they've never been tuned together as a set.
Ah,
so that's what we're doing. This particular one was actually cast here in 1870. So this is one of the newer bells.
Yes,
one of the bells, I think it's... Yes, I think it's that bell was cast in 1662. And we're retuning it. So
what is retuning? How on earth do you change a bell?
Scrape metal off of the inside, and you actually take metal off of different parts of the inside to alter the different partial tones within the bell.
Right.
Because a bell isn't just one single note, it's hundreds of notes, and it's the five lowest notes that are the most important that we're sort of trying to steer into some sort of semblance of musicality, both to try and make each individual bell sound as good as possible, and to make them try and sound as if they belong together as a set. Because we didn't have sophisticated pitching equipment and all this sort of stuff, even in 1870, let alone in 1662. I mean, we did actually have you can see the old lathe marks, but that was as far down the bell as we could tune. We couldn't sort of tune all the way up and sort of...
Saying,
And we didn't have a set of calibrated tuning forks in 1870. The biggest bell we've cast on this site was Big Ben, which is 13 and a half tonnes. Nowadays, with the furnace capacity we've got and everything else, we'd struggle to do more than about 7 tonnes.
What size is that?
It's going to be about 7 foot something in diameter at the mouth.
Right.
Bells, although they don't look it, they are actually shorter than they are wide. But yeah, it's an optical illusion. So yeah, probably about 6 foot tall, 7.5 foot wide. That sort of order of magnitude is what we can make up to on this side. Right the way down to the little tiny trinkets that we're making that we sell in the shop. And everything in between.
So the bell that's in Big Ben now, is that the same bell that
was
made here?
Yeah. Made here in 1858, I think.
What other famous bell? Is there any other famous?
The original Liberty Bell in America. They managed to crack it and they tried recasting it and they then managed to crack it again. But the original bell was cast here. And, of course, there's this Olympic bell, but we're sort of not really allowed to go into details about that.
Oh, I see.
But that, unfortunately, was too big for us to be able to cast here, unfortunately.
What are the bells made of?
Bronze. It's a high tin bronze. It's about 78% copper, 22% tin, and as little else as possible.
Bronze is still the best material for bells. The Victorians did try to make some in cast steel,
yes,
but that goes rusty and then the thing goes out of tune.
Well, that was just because in those days labour was cheap and metal was expensive, so a cast steel bell was a lot cheaper, whereas nowadays there wouldn't be much in it, so there's really no point.
Right.
I mean, actually the metal composition's changed remarkably little for 600-700 years. Thank you.
Time for a very short break, but stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Dominic, what's interesting is the fact that sort of urban manufacturing and craft is something that sort of needs a lot of preservation and attention. It's incredible that this still exists in the heart of London. Do you get a sense when you're there that it's dying or that it's struggling to stay alive, or is it sort of thriving?
I mean, I get a sense certainly the creative world is thriving in East London. I mean, particularly Hackney, you know, it's, well, from my experience, it seems to be the centre of, you can't walk down the street without meeting someone who makes something, you know. So I think that that side of things is really thriving. Now, whether the actual industry, you know, the factories are doing well, I'm not so sure. That's not really my world, but, you know, that's maybe something different. But definitely the handmade is going to
handmade, and also the history. I mean, we hear from the Bells, and we're going to hear from the Salmon Smokery in a second. These are companies that have incredible stories that go back generations, and in the case of the Bells, centuries. I mean, you can't just let those vanish or sort of start outsourcing that kind of production to China and end up with something that has the same resonance.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, places like China or India, you know, they can make things cheaply and they can make it in large quantities. But I think instead of competing with that, you know, we can do something unique to Britain. And, so I think it's right. You know, the example of the Alga Works going from the large scale to the bespoke item, I think that's quite fitting because that's the type of thing, quality. We can do quality. You know, made in Britain used to be, a wonderful thing, and then it seemed to have lost it a bit some along the way. But that was to do with big manufacturing. I think, we can do something unique and offer the world something different.
Definitely. Well, we mentioned the Olympics earlier, and this has obviously transformed East London. A little bit further east than Hackney, but still it's sort of disrupted quite a lot of manufacturers that were based there. And the next place we're going to hear from is the H. Foreman and Son Salmon Cura that's moved actually from the Olympic site itself, didn't it?
Yes, I believe they found a factory, built it, and then 2 years later were told they had to leave for the Olympics. So,
travesty.
Yeah, and there was a big hoo-ha, and but they've now set up their new factory in this huge place, and literally they've got a restaurant with a huge window, and you look out, and the Olympic Stadium is right in front. It fills the whole window, you know. So maybe they've turned it round themselves.
Full circle. Well, let's hear from them now.
We've been based in East London for 107 years, since 1905. We're a family business started by my great-grandfather. We've been in this particular factory for 4.5 years, and the reason we're here is because our previous place was located right in the middle of the Olympic Stadium, and we were booted out by the compulsory purchase. Where the Olympics is taking place was the greatest concentration of manufacturing land in the whole of London. So it's a huge manufacturing area, which all got moved on.
How does this compare to
our previous place? Yeah. Well, the previous place was a brand new factory. We just spent 2 years building it. And within a year of building it, we were told we've got to move out, which was a bit frustrating, particularly as we got grant funding from the London Development Agency to build it. And they were the same people that told us we had to move out. 2 years was wasted doing that. And the government, you know, the department clearly had the situation where the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing. And just a complete waste of our time. We're the oldest producers of smoked Scottish salmon in the country. The smoked salmon industry used to be based in the East End of London. We're now the last surviving of those original smokeries. And we believe the reason why we survived and the others didn't is because we carry on, you know, it's a real quality artisan operation. So everything we do here is done by hand. whereas the rest of the industry is just totally mechanised nowadays, and the quality of most other smoke salmon is just hopeless. We've never compromised our standards, and the quality of what we do is quite unique. And
you supply, what type of people do you supply?
We supply sort of top hotels and restaurants and food stores, although people can buy our smoked salmon in Waitrose now. But normally places like sort of Fortnum & Mason and Harvey Nichols, that sort of thing. But we supply the House of Lords and the Savoy Hotel, and indeed we export around the world to leading sort of hotels and restaurants, food stores, from New York to Hong Kong, the Caribbean, Mauritius, even a little bit in France.
So how many salmon do you get through in a week?
Not a huge amount. We bring in about 2 tonnes of salmon a day, which the minute you use the word tonne sounds like a lot, but it's not really that much.
Yeah.
We're not a mass producer, we're a small family business.
Yeah.
People often think we're a lot bigger than we are because we get a lot of media coverage because of the story and the battle that we had, but we're not a big business.
Was H. Foreman and Son, Salmon Cura. A lot of what we've spoken about has been about preservation, but there's also a lot of innovation happening. And one of the more interesting things, actually, that I found here was Sugru. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what Sugru is and what they do.
Yeah, Sugru is it's an air-drying rubber. So it's very much like plasticine, I guess, to play with. But then it can stick to any material pretty much, and then you leave it and it dries very strong material. So you can actually customize existing objects, make a handle easier to hold, or fix the end of it if your little lead connector to your stereos is coming frayed. You can fix it with this little bit of rubber around it. So what's great about it is that anybody, members of the public, creative people, are coming up with different uses for this new material. So they talked about a little bit about they're doing something with the Olympics, the fencing teams, and a couple of the individuals there who, of course, the grip of the...
What is that? Is it a sword? There's a sword, I think.
Yeah, there's a technical term for it. But anyway, yes, obviously the holding of the grip is very important, and so the working with Sugru. So there's lots of different ideas, and this is endless, I think.
And impressive. It's new. It's a material that might actually sort of change the way we live. That's a huge...
Well, I mean, I think they want it to be...
Something that might be incorporated into daily life.
Yes, I mean, like, if you think about blue tack
exactly. And
such like that, I think, their hope is that eventually it'll become like that and people will have it around the house.
Let's hear from Sugru.
Sugru is... brand new silicon technology, so it's sort of like Play-Doh, but you can mold it by hand, it bonds to most materials and turns into a silicon rubber overnight. So Sugru is the material that you can customize, modify, improve, repair literally anything with.
When was it first invented?
So Jane first invented a very base version of Sugru while at the RCA. In 2001 or 2, I can't quite remember the year, and spent time exploring the possibilities of a silicone material that was moldable by hand, and a self-adhesive silicone material that was moldable by hand. And after graduating, discovered that there's actually an audience for this. It required about 5 years of R&D to turn the idea, which had a rough prototype, into a product. Something that had really good properties. It was stable in a pack and everything else.
Right. When you first introduced it to the public, what were the initial ideas people were coming up with using it?
My favourites and the most common, I guess, are the really mundane, everyday things, like a cracked drawer in the fridge. Actually, the fridge, the freezer doors in the fridge freezer, the little lift-up panels on the top of a freezer.
Yeah.
A lot of the people were repairing those, which is... pretty nice because everybody knows they break pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Dishwasher repairs were pretty common, cable repairs, just tons and tons of different stuff. And in many respects, that hasn't changed. So when people discover Sugru, they these problems, the solutions, I guess, are common to everybody.
So what's the latest things you're doing with Sugru? Because this, how many people work here now?
Oh God, something like 18 or 20.
Really?
Yeah. And it's amazing because originally there was two of us, three of us. So we used to do everything. And now you have people who do specific things tons of times better than we were ever able to do them. Mm-hmm. So people with skill sets far greater than ours in specific areas. Mm-hmm. And allows us to focus on our strengths, I guess.
Yeah.
We've been working with Leon Paul. They're based in Hendon, actually. Well worth a visit. Mm-hmm. They do an awful lot of their own manufacture on site there. Fifth generation fencing manufacturer. They got in touch with us about 20 months ago, 21 months ago or something. They discovered us in the Design Museum exhibition. And for about a decade, they've wanted to make custom fencing grips, but could never find the technology for it. And then they had the insight and the vision to go, Sugru could do it. And Alex bought, I think, 5 packs at the time, went straight back and went crazy on the equipment. And his initial concern was, does it stick to aluminium? And he was thrilled when he discovered actually bonds like crazy. So we've worked really closely since then to design and develop the very first product in the world to be designed and built around Sugru. And it's a beautiful object. I think it's going to be quite disruptive because it'll be the first time, I think, that a product is designed to be customized. When you buy it, it's incomplete and you have to stick rubber onto it to make it work for you.
That was Sugru self-setting rubber being made and packaged in East London. So the LP is now ready as an incredible souvenir for people to buy and hear about all the industry and craft that takes place in East London. Is there a limited number of LPs that you've made?
There was 500 made. If you visit soundsofmaking.com, that's where I put all of the photographs, the interviews, and then there's a link to the buy, to be able to buy one of these records.
And has it opened your eyes to your sort of home, your doorstep now? And, you know, do you open your ears maybe?
Well, I mean, I suppose you certainly find the little secrets. You know, there was places I visited that have no name on the door. You know, and you don't know unless you've been told that there's behind that door is someone making this, that and the other. So yes, it has opened my eyes a little bit.
Wonderful. Well, to play us out, maybe you could choose one sound. Which sound would you sort of choose to, if you could only listen to one for the rest of your life?
Well, I mean, let's go to, this is Broadway Market. Let's go back to the traditional makers. And this is the pie and mash maker. It's F. Cook's.
Yum.
Yes.
Birds squawking in the background.
There was a lot of that went on in the background.
Dominic Wilcox, thank you very much indeed for coming in and sharing some of the sounds of East London with us. And yes, to get your hands on one of the LPs, visit soundsofmaking.com.
Thank you very much.
And that brings us to the end of this week's Section D. Next week, we're off to Sweden for Stockholm Fashion Week. We'll be bringing you a cast of characters and stories from brands old and young from across the city. Today's show was produced by Alexander Mills and edited by Holly Fisher. Finally, we're staying in London's Hackney to play you out with a song by local talent Cock and Bull Kid. This is Yellow. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Thank you for listening. Sleeping with